headlines this hour. Iran airs the confessions of two French spies admitting to their support for anti-government protests and regime change efforts in Iran. The leader of Palestinian group the Islamic Jihad says people of Palestine and its resistance forces will never surrender to Israel. And the International Monetary Fund chief downgrades the economic outlook for 2023, warns global recession risks are rising. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Iran has released a video of two French spies arrested some 4 months ago, in which they've admitted to their efforts to incite chaos and unrest in the country. One of the spies has admitted to being an agent at the French Foreign Intelligence Agency, known as the General Directorate for External Security. She proceeds to explain how they brought in large sums of cash in order to fund riots and strikes, as well as purchase weaponry in an attempt to stir up chaos. She also states that their main aim was to lay the groundwork for mass unrest and trigger a revolution in Iran. The Iranian Ministry of Intelligence announced their arrests in late May. The ministry stated that they had entered the country with the aim of hijacking peaceful rallies to create social disorder. Iran says when human rights becomes a tool to exert political pressure on others, the media empire helps those accused of systematic violations to be placed in the position of claimants. Comments were made by Iran's foreign ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani. He said the world has not yet forgotten the sad narratives of the forced separation of over 150,000 indigenous children from their families and the discovery of mass graves of hundreds of children in Canada. He said talking about other countries does not change the fact that behind the human rights showcase of one of the closest allies of the U.S. government, infanticide and disregard for humanity is displayed. Ottawa has imposed fresh sanctions on 34 Iranian individuals and entities over alleged human rights violations. Iran is calling for the Caspian Littoral States to create an oil and gas cooperation committee. First, Vice President Mohammad Mokhber broached the proposal during the second meeting of the Caspian Economic Forum in Moscow. Iranian officials said the Caspian Sea is a mutual heritage and a connection hub among its littoral states. He said that countries bordering the sea need to expand cooperation in various fields. The forum initiated in 2018 is meant to act as a platform to discuss economic cooperation, transport, and security. Representatives from Russia, Turkmenistan, Kazakhstan, Azerbaijan, and Iran have attended the event. The head of the International Monetary Fund says global economy faces a gloomy picture as the IMF will downgrade its growth projections for next year.
We have downgraded three times since October last year our growth projections. Last time we brought 22 to 3.2% growth, and for 23 projections was 2.9%. We will see, we always come around the annual meetings with our World Economic Outlook, that we are further downgrading our growth projections for next year.
Kristalina Georgieva warned that recession risks across the globe are rising as a result of repeated shocks to the global economy. She urged policymakers to take concerted action to avoid a dangerous new normal. Georgieva underlined the need to stabilize the global economy by addressing the most immediate challenges, but she said the process could be painful. The IMF chief warned if central banks move too aggressively to tamp down price pressures, it could trigger a, quote, prolonged economic downturn. Soaring inflation, higher borrowing costs, and lingering supply chain disruptions have dealt a heavy blow to the global economy over the past few years. Soaring energy prices in Italy continue to bite. The Italian Retailers Association has announced that hundreds of thousands of firms are at the risk of closure next year as recession looms on the country's economic horizon.
On Wednesday, Italy's largest retailers association, Confcommercio, warned that over 120,000 small businesses risk shutting down in the first half of 2023. The association said firms are squeezed by the cost of living and skyrocketing energy prices. The president of Confcommercio, Carlo Sangalli, urged the government to do more to shield small and medium entrepreneurs, as the situation for many is now very critical.
There is the risk of a high number of business closures in the coming 9 months. Some small firms will simply find it more convenient to suspend their activity rather than losing 200 to 300 euros a day. Having said that, Italy will soon face a mild recession, which frankly is not as worrying as the media depict it.
Last month, Italy's outgoing government approved an aid package worth some 14 billion euros in an attempt to shield firms and families from surging energy costs. The measure came on top of over 50 billion euros already budgeted since January to soften the energy crisis in the country. However, the aid seems to be insufficient as an increasing number of businesses are struggling to stay afloat.
Everything costs at least 20% more. Energy prices keep soaring and it is very hard to keep going. We need help. The government must do something.
I cannot afford paying expenses for my family. I have four dependent children. They're all unemployed. Bills keep going up. How do we cope?
According to Confcommercio, more than 370,000 jobs are at risk as a result of the energy crisis. Meanwhile, energy giant Eni announced that gas supplies to Italy from Russia have resumed after 4 days. Russia's state-controlled Gazprom cut off gas supplies to Italy on Saturday, citing a problem linked to regulatory changes in Austria. Italy's national energy regulator ARERA warned last week that prices would climb by almost 60% by the end of the year, but experts argue that its estimate was optimistic. Bills have risen by 93% in Italy over the past 2 years, and the conflict between Russia and Ukraine, together with the damage recently sustained by Nord Stream pipelines, is likely to push costs even higher. Max Civioli, Rome.
The U.S. negative economic data continues to pile up. 5 weeks into the midterms, a record plunge in the number of job openings, as many declaring that the country is officially in a recession. Ramin Mazari has more from Chicago.
New jobs data in the United States showed a collapse of 1.1 million job openings, the biggest one-month crash ever outside of the COVID lockdown. It's also the first increase in the unemployment rate since April 2020, and that has many so-called recession deniers being forced to reconsider. The United States has had two consecutive quarters of negative economic growth, which is the standard definition of economic recession. However, in an effort to avoid the negative press the recession label receives, the administration of President Joe Biden claimed that a stable unemployment rate meant that the U.S. was not in a recession. That's no longer possible. Due to the so-called Uberization of the United States economy, the official data has long been accused of falsely portraying a rosy picture. The national unemployment rate is 4%, but many say the jobs available are part-time or lack crucial benefits like health care, or are poorly paid despite the current record inflation.
People looking for benefits, they want to work from home. People are not settling like they used to. It's just a matter of, I don't want to say laziness, but I think people are just, they're trying to get the best that they want, and companies are trying to hold steady and their wages, and they're not willing to pay as much because costs are going up for them as well.
Amid the backfiring of Western sanctions on Russia, many businesses have responded by cutting job listings, slowing the hiring process, and may begin mass layoffs.
Now we've got the threat of recession, so some employers are cutting back on their hiring. My son-in-law just had to fire several people he had who were hiring people, so they're cutting back on their hiring process based on a precautionary measure, thinking there might be a recession.
The widespread perception is that America's central bank is forcing a recession to reduce inflation, even if that means throwing millions out of work, out of their homes, and guts pensions, which are usually based on the stock market. The drop in jobs is the latest piece of data which shows a dangerously worsening economic situation for the average American. Wages are losing ground to inflation at a record pace, and an economically chaotic October could translate into a painful holiday season for many. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
It's time now for the news review of this bulletin. The leader of Islamic Jihad says Palestinians are forming new equations to counter plots by the Zionist regime. On the 35th anniversary of the establishment of the Islamic Jihad, Ziad al-Nakhala said the resistance was set up to bring the, quote, message of unity against the Zionists. Nakhala said that the Zionist enemy seeks to turn the Palestinian cause into a mere humanitarian issue. He said resistance against occupation must go on in Palestine. Nakhala said that Israel enjoys full support of its allies, the U.S. in particular, but he said the resolute people of Palestine will never give in to enemy plots until the full liberation of their homeland. Our correspondent Ashraf Shannon joins us from Gaza City to tell us more about that. Barry Grossman is an international lawyer joining us from Bali in order to break this down for us a little bit. Ashraf Shannon, tell us what happened in terms of what Nakhala said, some of the highlights of his speech.
Ziad Nakhala, Secretary General of Islamic Jihad, during his speech to the masses today, he talked about the importance of unity among Palestinians to resist the Israeli occupation. He also highlighted the importance of strengthening the axis of resistance. And also the importance of defending Al-Quds. He said that the fighting for Al-Quds will last as long as it takes, even if it takes 1,000 years to fight the Israeli regime. He also praised the support of the Islamic Republic of Iran, and also praised the support of Syria and the Yemeni people and the Lebanese people. He also saluted the martyrs, especially of the last Israeli onslaught during the three-day war in August, Kaveh.
Barry Grossman, this is obviously one of the resistance groups that represents what it stands for, which is against what it calls the Zionist entity or Israel. Hasn't its success in still having such support from its own people in the Gaza Strip, for example, show that Israel has failed in trying to break up these resistance groups, the Islamic Jihad being one of them?
Absolutely. And to be clear, the strength of Islamic Jihad isn't solely in Gaza. It also has strongholds in the West Bank, and that's because from the start Islamic Jihad has stood for a very basic proposition that's very difficult to challenge, namely that Palestinians must be permitted to establish a state within the 1948 borders, and that there is no political process which can achieve that result. So the only way to achieve it is through military action or resistance. And of course, it's that position which got Islamic Jihad designated in 1987 by the United States a terrorist organization, something that was quickly followed by most Atlantic world countries. But I like to remind people that we really should evaluate these organizations by what was deemed to be acceptable and indeed even celebrated as a heroic cause during World War II. And there's nothing which Islamic Jihad promotes which is contrary to what the armed resistance throughout Europe in fighting the Nazis promoted during World War II. As for the Zionist entity, Israel, they've made it very clear that there is no political solution. There will be no negotiation except for a complete capitulation. And the U.S. has presumed to dictate to Palestinians that they're not entitled to have recourse to the usual international organizations and international law in order to resolve their differences. Instead, the machine misrepresents the position of Islamic Jihad, in part by saying, for example, that by calling for the destruction of Israel, they're in essence promoting a form of Jewish ethnic cleansing, when in fact the leadership of Islamic Jihad has made it very clear, crystal clear, that they have no problem with Jews. They're prepared to live side by side with Jews in Palestine on an equal footing. That their problem is with Zionism, with the Zionist entity, and the acts of terrorism that are being carried out by the Zionist entity against Palestinian people. That makes Islamic Jihad a very heroic cause. And to be clear, and I'll finish on this for a moment, along with other Palestinian organizations, they gave peace a chance for a decade following the Second Intifada by unilaterally abandoning tactics which led to what Israel characterized as deaths from acts of terrorism by more than 95%. There was a 95% reduction in each and every year of those 10 years across the board in fatal attacks by Palestinians on Israelis. And in return for giving peace a chance, the Zionist regime tried to push home the advantage by carrying out numerous full-fledged assaults on Gaza using the very latest military technology provided by the United States, killing tens of thousands of people and destroying many more tens of thousands of homes and other infrastructure. So everyone has made it very clear that the only thing the Palestinians can do is do what the resistance movements did in Europe to fight the Nazis during World War II, which is exercise their lawful right to armed resistance.
Well,
and that's
what
Islamic Jihad stands for.
Thank you very much for that, Barry Grossman, international lawyer from Bali, Indonesia. Ashraf Shannon, thank you so much, of course, correspondent there from Gaza City. And with that, we come to the end for this edition of The News Review. Thanks for tuning in.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
in the limelight.
The United States is the only large, wealthy country in the world that doesn't have universal health care. The U.S. healthcare system ranks last among high-income countries. And the bad news comes when the media announces yet another drop in life expectancy in the United States for the second year in a row, which should be blamed mostly for the poor healthcare system in this country. In this regard, we have taken a look at the world media for further details on this issue. The title of the article is "The U.S. Experiences Drop in Life Expectancy for Second Year in a Row." Stay tuned, please. Truthout website recently wrote, "Life expectancy in the United States has dropped for the second year in a row, a decline that is largely due to the coronavirus pandemic and the country's inequitable healthcare system. Before the pandemic, the average life expectancy in the U.S. was 78 years and 10 months. In 2020, that number dropped to 77 years, and last year, it dropped to 76 years and 1 month. The last time the nation's life expectancy was this low was more than two decades ago, in 1996. The current drop is the largest two-year decline in the U.S. in almost 100 years of tracking the data. The life expectancy for members of marginalized communities has undergone a particularly precipitous drop. Over the past 2 years, the life expectancy for Native Americans and Alaska Natives dropped by around 6.6 years. It's a ridiculous decline. When I saw a 6.6-year decline over 2 years, my jaw dropped. I made my staff rerun the numbers to make sure," said Robert Anderson, chief of Mortality Statistics Branch of the National Center for Health Statistics. The life expectancy for Native Americans and Alaska Natives is now just 65 years, according to the new numbers. This figure is equivalent to the nation's life expectancy overall in 1940s. According to the Truthout, these numbers were released in a government report recently which cited the pandemic as the central reason for the decline. But experts say additional factors played a role, as other wealthy nations have not seen the same drops, and some have begun to see their life expectancies recover from declines brought on by the pandemic. Stephen Wolf, Director Emeritus of Center on Society and Health at Virginia Commonwealth University, attributes the discrepancy to the fact that other countries have had more effective vaccination campaigns and populations that are more willing to social distance and wear masks. The U.S. healthcare system has also contributed to the decline, he said. While the U.S. is a world leader in terms of what kind of care it can provide, there are widespread socioeconomic disparities that make access to care more difficult, particularly for marginalized communities. Wolf said to the New York Times, "The United States is clearly an outlier. Notably, the U.S. is the only large wealthy country in the world without universal health care." And New York Times had this headline, "U.S. life expectancy falls again in historic setback. It wrote the decline during the pandemic is the sharpest in nearly 100 years, hitting Native American and Alaska Native communities particularly hard. The average life expectancy of Americans fell precipitously in 2020 and 2021, the sharpest two-year decline in nearly 100 years, and a stark reminder of the toll exacted on the nation by the continuing coronavirus pandemic. In 2021, the average American could expect to live until the age of 76, federal health researchers reported recently. The figure represents a loss of almost 3 years since 2019, when Americans could expect to live an average nearly 79 years. The reduction has been particularly steep among Native Americans and Alaska Natives, the National Center for Health Statistics reported. Average life expectancy in those groups was shortened by 4 years in 2020 alone. The culminative decline since the pandemic started, more than 6.5 years on average, has brought life expectancy to 65 among Native Americans and Alaska Natives, on par with the figure for all Americans in 1944. In 2021, the shortening of lifespan was more pronounced among white Americans than among black Americans, who saw greater reductions in the first year of the pandemic. According to New York Times, while the pandemic has driven most of the decline in life expectancy, a rise in accidental deaths and drug overdoses also contributed, as did deaths from heart disease, chronic liver disease, and diabetes. This is, until now, experts have been accustomed to measuring life expectancy changes in increments of months, not years. Even small declines in life expectancy of a tenth or two-tenths of a year mean that, on a population level, a lot more people are dying prematurely than they really should be, said Robert Anderson, chief of mortality statistics at the NCHS. But the coronavirus was not solely to blame. Long-standing health problems rooted in poverty, discrimination, and poor access to healthcare left Native Americans and Alaska Natives particularly vulnerable to the virus, said Dr. Ann Bullock, former director of diabetes treatment and prevention at the Federal Indian Health Service Agency and a member of the Minnesota Chippewa tribe. New York Times says one in seven Native Americans and Alaska Natives has diabetes, the highest rate among racial or ethnic groups in the United States of America, and many struggle with obesity or excess weight. Both conditions make people more susceptible to severe COVID-19. And crowded, multi-generational housing adds to the risk. Americans suffer from what experts have called the U.S. health disadvantage, an amalgam of influences that erode well-being, Dr. Wolf said. These include a fragmented, profit-driven healthcare system, poor diet, and a lack of physical activity, and pervasive risk factors such as smoking, widespread access to guns, poverty, and pollution. The problems are compounded for marginalized groups by racism and segregation, he added. The result is a high disease burden among Americans and shorter life expectancy compared with that in comparable high-income nations over the last two decades, Dr. Wolf said. Over a million Americans have died of COVID-19 and more died in 2021 than in 2020, despite the availability of vaccines. To date, only two-thirds of Americans are fully vaccinated and only one-third have had a booster shot.
Hidden Files. But Cece never saw her husband's face again because her plane crashed that morning at 10:03. What took place on 9/11 was the deadliest attack on U.S. soil ever, which took the lives of almost 3,000 people. People whom some of their heartbreaking stories have been told and retold over and over again by mainstream media. But the greatest toll this incident took was neither on September the 11th nor in America. And that's where millions more heartbreaking stories are waiting to be heard. Hello and welcome to Hidden Files. I'm Marzia Hashimi, and today I'm here to share with you stories of the fall of people who had nothing to do with the 9/11 attacks, people who fell victim to the campaign that started following September 11th, a campaign named the War on Terror. Following the September 11th attacks, U.S. President George W. Bush declared a global military war on terror campaign. He called on world leaders to join the U.S. in this fight and said, every nation in every region now has a decision to make. Either you are with us or with the terrorists. Bush then stated how this war on terror was to unfold. Our war on terror begins with Al-Qaeda, but it does not end there. It will not end until every terrorist group of global reach has been found, stopped, and defeated. Well, let's look at how a lot of these events unfolded. October the 7th, 2001, airstrikes were launched in Afghanistan by the U.S. and the U.K., followed by a ground offensive. And more than 240,000 Afghans were killed as a direct result. And then if we go forward to March the 19th, 2003, U.S. and coalition forces invaded Iraq, claiming that the country had weapons of mass destruction. More than 300,000 Iraqis were killed as a direct result. Today, the War on Terror campaign continues to be used as an excuse for bombing people from Afghanistan to Yemen. According to the Cost of War Project, by 2021, over 900,000 people had been killed in the War on Terror, and over 80 countries are currently being targeted by the War on Terror today. But was this War on Terror campaign a sudden decision in the aftermath of 9/11? Or were the attacks used as an excuse to justify a full-fledged pre-planned war? Well, our first guest, Scott Ritter, who is a whistleblower and former intelligence officer, is here with us to discuss more.
Scott Ritter, United States Marine Corps intelligence officer, who was a chief weapons inspector with the UN in Iraq from 1991 to 1998. Mr. Ritter quit the inspections team in 1998. He became a whistleblower and a critic of the Bush administration's claims that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction.
Thanks so much for being with us, Scott, here on Hidden Files. I mean, can you explain your perspective exactly what the concept of war on terror means?
We were attacked on 9/11. Now, we can have a discussion about whether or not this was blowback from, you know, decades of American malpractice and malfeasance in the Middle East. That's a fair point. But we did not invite this attack. We did not want this attack. We did not will this attack. We were attacked. And, you know, the world saw that and recognized that. That's why the world rallied behind the United States in the aftermath of 9/11, saying this was unwarranted. This was unjust. This was horrible. And we will support the United States. But they weren't willing to support the United States in carrying out a counteroffensive that went beyond simply punishing those who perpetrated the attack. And that's what the war on terror became. It wasn't about punishing Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden. It was about American asserting dominance on an entire region. And indeed, by doing so, on the entire world. And that's what the war on terror was. It wasn't a war on terror. It was basically a war of regional and global domination by the United States using a horrible act of terrorism as justification.
Well, don't you feel that there was a plan to attack Iraq even prior to the September 11th attacks?
I think the Department of Defense had been heavily engaged with Iraq over the decade of the 90s, and that there were military contingencies in place that could have the United States defeating Iraq, occupying Iraq. These were plans. They weren't necessarily fully developed. The CIA would play a supporting role in that, but there is ample evidence that the United States had plans in the works for invading and occupying Iraq prior to 9/11.
Well, what are some of the lingering effects of the U.S. war on Iraq?
The war in Iraq has never ended. I mean, it continues to this day. The political instability that we see in Baghdad is a direct consequence of the decision by the United States to invade and occupy Iraq in 2003.
Well, do you think that the U.S. would have invaded Iraq even if the 9/11 attacks hadn't taken place, since Iraq really had nothing to do with those attacks anyway?
I think the events of 9/11 accelerated the inevitable military conflict between the United States and Iraq that had been brewing for over a decade since the end of Operation Desert Storm in 1991. The Clinton administration in 1998 had put in place a law that basically codified regime change as the official policy of the United States government. And the United States was moving toward a decisive confrontation with Iraq that would have occurred whether or not 9/11 took place. I think 9/11 accelerated this. But the American public was already pre-programmed to accept the notion that Saddam Hussein was an evil that needed to be confronted and destroyed. And they were unquestioning about the weapons of mass destruction narrative that was being put forward by the United States government well before 9/11.
Well, in your perspective, who benefited from the war?
I mean, the short-term benefit was getting rid of Saddam Hussein, who had proven to be a perpetual thorn in the side of multiple American presidential administrations. His continued survival was an embarrassment to the United States. But beyond that, the United States gained no benefit. This was a colossal failure. It was a failure from almost day one. We never won over the Iraqi people. We were always seen as an occupying force. And that notion of the American occupier flew in the face of what we were trying to promote, which is the role of the United States as a liberator, promulgating the model of American democracy as something that should be emulated regionally. Instead, we became the brutal occupier, and we turned the region and indeed much of the world against us. There's nothing positive that came out of America's precipitous invasion and occupation of Iraq.
Well, thank you so much for being with us right here on Hidden Files, Scott Ritter. Now, the war on terror was not limited to bombing locations claimed to be terrorist hotspots in different countries. It entailed control of countries and their resources. One example of such control was when Paul Bremer, an American diplomat, was deployed to Iraq, where he became the country's chief executive authority following the U.S.'s invasion. Now, he wanted to implement 100 different orders in Iraq through one of Bremer's orders. The Iraqi army was dismantled, also using Coalition Provisional Authority, CPA. Bremer changed the Iraqi constitution to benefit American authorities. For instance, CPA's draft included banning political parties opposed to the U.S.'s occupation from participating in elections, and so from the U.S. controlling any government that would come to be in Iraq, to the country even losing autonomy over its seed bank for farming, every aspect of life in Iraq was affected. Neoliberalism was being infused throughout the country, and it wasn't the Iraqi people who were profiting. There was a major heist during the occupation on so many levels, from cultural artifacts being stolen to the national wealth of the country's oil being completely controlled by the U.S. to the billions of dollars that Western contractors won. Now, let's take a look at some of these contractors.
The number of contractors on the ground outnumbered U.S. troops most years of the U.S. occupation. American politicians were invested in the contractors. Many of them owned stocks in these contractors' companies. U.S. politicians had personal interests and stocks in these contractors. 51 congressmen and women, along with their spouses, owned between $2.3 and $5.8 million worth of stocks in the top 30 defense contractor companies. The Big Five, Lockheed Martin, Boeing, General Dynamics, Raytheon and Northrop Grumman, and some others acquired the next tier of manufacturers such as Hughes Aircraft and McDonnell Douglas. In the year to June 2020, the Big Five accounted for nearly a third of the $480 billion obligated by the Pentagon to defense contractors. Meanwhile, the defense sector spent over $2.4 billion lobbying Congress since 2001. These defense contractors make direct campaign contributions to most congressional members. 1. Lockheed Martin. Total sales, $46.5 billion. Gross profit, $2.7 billion. 2. Boeing. Total sales, $68.7 billion. Gross profit, $4 billion. 3. BAE. Total sales, $30.7 billion. Gross profit, $2.3 billion. 4. General Dynamics. Total sales, $32.7 billion. Gross profit, $2.5 billion. 5. Northrop Grumman. Total sales, $26.4 billion. Gross profit, $2.1 billion.
I'd like to welcome my next guest to the program, Dr. Ranjit Brar.
Ranjit Brar. Dr. Brar is a political analyst, a journalist, and a public speaker. He has been actively involved in the British anti-war movement for 30 years. Brar regularly contributes to the workers' journals Proletarian and Laocoon. He is the author of Britain's Road to Socialism.
Thanks so much for joining me. Do you feel that there was a plan to attack Iraq prior to the September 11th attacks?
Well, I think the clearest indication that there was a pre-existing plan to attack Iraq prior to September 11th, 2001, was, of course, the fact that the original invasion of Iraq had taken place in 1990-1991 under George H. Bush. At that time, whilst Saddam Hussein was much weakened and Iraq was much weakened, and the oil for food program of quite draconian sanctions was installed upon Iraq. And famously, Madeleine Albright, of course, at that time said it was worth the pain inflicted on the Iraqi people, in particular the 500,000 children who died of malnutrition and related diseases due to those sanctions. Madeleine Albright quite clearly said, yes, it was worth it. So there was obviously a pre-existing plan to invade Iraq. In terms of the 2003 invasion, there had been a plan. General Wesley Clark gave an interview in which he quite clearly said, in around the 2001 attacks, when he was visiting Rumsfeld and Wolfowitz in the Pentagon, they'd clearly intimated him a plan not only to attack Iraq, but in fact a list of seven other countries in the immediate future.
Well, do you think the attacks were needed to use as justification for invading these countries?
In terms of whether 9/11, September 11, the attacks on the Twin Towers, Pentagon, and White House, because let's not forget it was all three sites that were initially attacked, were a useful justification. They were certainly used as a useful justification. Were they necessary to justify those acts of aggression by the United States? Personally, whilst they were clearly, you know, they pitched their media to a level of hysteria and hyperbole not seen before or since, and pivoted towards the war on terror as justification for all of their aggressive operations abroad. In fact, that was nothing new in a sense, and really the Monroe Doctrine since 1847 had declared, you know, U.S. Right to dominate the Western Hemisphere, the Americas, as their own territorial sphere of interest, as their own colony, their de facto colony, their zone to exploit. Was in the aftermath of the collapse of the Soviet Union, really, that the United States and Bush, after Reagan, had really said there would be a new world order. This was the era in which America would be a world policeman, in which they would really come to now dominate the globe. And that unipolar moment, as we can call it, is a historical moment, has been continuing to this day. So was September 11th used by the United States establishment? Absolutely. Did they need that to justify their aggressive and hostile actions? Well, if you look at the American history, there have been perhaps 4 or 5 years in the total history of America when they've not been at war with one or another country. It's a country founded on genocide, essentially, and an empire founded upon ongoing bloodshed. There's not really been a single day's peace since the Second World War. America has been continual at war with other nations around the globe. So my personal feeling is that while they used it to their own advantage, they spun the media into a state of frenzy. They would have done exactly the same had September the 11th not occurred.
Who benefited from the war on Iraq?
That's a very good question. So the precise figures of the profits made by the U.S. state, and in particular U.S. companies, are hard to calculate. They will certainly run into hundreds of billions and trillions of dollars, and that would be the direct looting of Iraq's oil, which was the fundamental reason for going in. Saddam Hussein, of course, was threatening to flout U.S. diktat, no longer comply with producing the necessary quantities of oil at the necessary prices in the interests of the U.S., and rather was going to cooperate with OPEC. So they lost control of Saddam Hussein, and this very important Iraq has perhaps 10 to 15% of the world's proven oil reserves, as has other important countries, of course, including Iran and Kuwait, Saudi in the region. What were the other things they benefited from? So the war itself, the incredible military expenditure. U.S. has a military budget of $850 billion per annum on military, more than enough to solve the vast majority of the world's problems in healthcare, in nutrition, and in housing. But of course, that money is not dedicated to solving those problems, but to reinforcing America's exploitation of the world and their exploitative position. But Lockheed Martin, Boeing, so many US defense contractors and companies made literally a killing, but absolute fortune in monetary terms from the war itself and from the sales of weapons to the American government, to the British government, to the coalition of the willing, so-called, and to other nations based on their testing of weapons on an army which, relatively speaking, was absolutely unable to defend itself against this huge onslaught of the world's largest industrial powers under the NATO umbrella. In addition to that, of course, there were huge contracts for reconstruction and occupation of Iraq over an extended period of time. And given the size of the bases and contractors who still operate in Iraq, you can see that those profits and loot are ongoing. And of course, ultimately, all of the money to pay for all of those operations came, in addition to an extent from the American taxpayer, overwhelmingly from loot extracted from the Iraq. And that includes, incidentally, the confiscation of the gold bullion reserves of the central bank. So however you look at it, this was an absolute, not even a neo-colonial, but a classical colonial operation of plunder, which meant that Iraq went from being one of the most prosperous countries on earth, more prosperous than most southern European nations, more prosperous than Spain, arguably more prosperous than Italy, certainly more prosperous than Greece, to being one of the poorest countries on earth, where chaos still rules. And this is precisely, of course, the intended desire, because while that chaos rules, while the Iraqi people can't demand the repatriation of their oil wealth, that looting continues.
Can you explain the concept of war on terror and how it served those who instigated this concept?
The concept of the war on terror was a very useful device to find a new enemy to justify the reason for not only ongoing military expenditure, ongoing NATO alliance, but in fact it's constant expansion. Have we seen NATO has been expanding right up towards the borders of Russia and China? So global domination, in fact, was the name of the game, but that was portrayed, you know, as America was a victim, America was the great upholder of democracy, America would be the world's policeman. It was America's mission to go and impose, you know, democracy, the free market, and institutions of NATO, EU, and other military alliances, essentially that served their own military and economic machine. So this essentially was making the world safe for the penetration of American capital. But, you know, war after war after war was fought against people after people to stop them having independent governments that would put the interests of those nations first.
Well, thank you so much for being with us right here in Hidden Files. September 11th was indeed a tragic event, but thanks to mainstream media, what many don't realize is that the main victims of the 9/11 incident were not Americans. They were unarmed civilians. They were Iraqi families, unsuspecting of who may break into their homes. Other victims of 9/11 were women and children being terrorized in their homes, and many are still being born with signs of terror all over their bodies, with horrifying birth defects due to depleted uranium and other chemicals. Birth defects like they were killed, wounded, and uprooted, not in the thousands, but in the millions. And yet there were neither paid reparations, nor did they even receive an official apology. And more importantly, there has been no accountability for the crimes committed, as trillions of dollars have been spent to cause havoc and to line the pockets of those heavily invested in war and chaos. Well, Hidden Files will continue to bring your attention to what's going on with this war on terror that was declared 21 years ago and is still causing death and destruction around the globe. Now, that's it for me, Marzia Hashimi, and all the crew here this week on Hidden Files.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.